Blog Talk Radio.
Our roots began in Africa, where we enjoyed self-determination and freedom, which were rooted in our sovereignty. Peace, family. Welcome to Dare to Win, the Us Lifting Us weekly radio program that airs every Thursday evening from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Dare to Win is the place where we have sobering conversations about the economic plight of Black people and the imperative that we build the global economic machinery that will free us and once again put us on the path of making history. We at Us Lifting Us have developed an exact methodology on how to build this global machinery and pass it forward to our children and future generations. To join tonight's conversation, please call 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your phone when you want to make a comment or ask a question. If you prefer to listen on your computer, go to www.uslistingus.com. Scroll down to the bottom of the homepage. Click on the Dare to Win button, then click on Listen Live. At that time, you will be on the Blog Talk Radio site. If you want to get reminders from Blog Talk Radio for upcoming Dare to Win programs, click on the Follow button. ULU members, we have our own social media community. Please join if you have not already done so. There is a Dare to Win group, and we would like to have your feedback on past Dare to Win programs, as well as topic suggestions for future programs. Go to usliftingus.com. You can reach the ULU community through the members-only portal. When you register for the ULU community, please use the same name you use to join ULU. I'm Sister Q, and joining me for this evening's discussion is Brother Anki, who, like me, is a member of ULU. Tonight's topic is Only Love for Self will fall fashion. Peace, Brother Auntie. How are you doing tonight?
Peace, Sister Q. Good to hear you. Good to be with the family, and I'm doing well.
It's good to have you again. Brother Auntie, I'd like to begin tonight's discussion with a couple of definitions. For the purpose of tonight's talk, what do you mean by love for self? What does it look like? How can we recognize it? What kind of attitude or whatever do we see in people who have a genuine love for self?
Thank you for the question, and it is an excellent question. It really goes to the heart of what we hope to get into this evening.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, love as used here, I'm taking that from the definition of love given in the 11 laws of Ma'at by Ra Unefa Amin. When talking about the principle of Ma'at, he says that Ma'at is, he talks about Ma'at being love, and love is the executive force in the universe. Now, here's the essence of the point, the first point that I'd like to make tonight. His definition of love is giving, seeking nothing in return. Giving, seeking nothing in return. Some people refer to that as unconditional love. It's certainly a non-transactional love. In other words, too often we've been conditioned because we've grown up in America and in places that are dominated by non-African folk, we've been exposed to a kind of selfish love. so we're familiar with the erotic love, you know, I like the way you look and let's get together. Or the kinship kind of love, philia or filial, sisterly, brotherly love. But these tend to be an understanding of love where as long as you do what I expect you to do, or you do what I like, or you do what I tell you to do, we're cool. But if you do something that I'm not expecting or don't do what I'm asking you to do, now we have a problem, and we tend to fall out with each other. So we're not talking about that. That's a very narrow and incomplete understanding of love. What we're delving into this evening is this much deeper understanding of a way of being together in the world where I give to you, whether you receive it or not, whether you reciprocate it or not, I am giving, seeking absolutely nothing in return. And quiet as is kept, that's also an expression of divine love or divinity. In other words, when we think about the gift of creation to the human family, it's like the sun shines whether we do what the Creator asks us to do or not, right? Every morning, the sun comes over the horizon, we get the rain, everything necessary for life is provided regardless of how well we are behaving or not. And so this idea of being with other people, being in community, being in a long-term relationship where we've made a decision, because this is not driven by an emotion, a warm, fuzzy feeling. This is driven by a decision to give regardless, and to give without expecting anything in return. So that's the first point. That's the kind of love that we're talking about, this idea of extending to another person or to another group of persons, whatever it is that we have to offer, whether it's musical gifts or musical talent or graphic art ability, whether it's dance, whether it's computing skills, all of us discover that there are certain things that we are very good at doing. And mm-hmm. when we share that those gifts just for the sheer joy of doing it, then others receive it and to use a church term, are blessed by that, right? So
right,
that's the idea that we're trying to convey this evening, this idea of giving, seeking nothing in return. Now, that's big boy and big girl stuff. Immature people,
for sure.
That's not something that comes easily. And this is something that has to be cultivated over time, and it's something that we have to be very intentional about doing. But once we've made the decision that that's how we're going to roll, then it changes the entire energy around our person and how we interact with others. And what we find is that it's a very healing energy, and it produces of its own kind. In other words, so, the idea of sowing and reaping, when you put this kind of energy out, it's magnified and multiplied, and it comes back, and it just keeps circulating over and over and over. So I think that's the first point that has to be understood. Now,
thank you.
That may cause us to wrestle a little bit, but let me just throw in the second piece, and then you can take us in how you're led to do this. When I say only love for self, I'm not talking about just the physical person. The self that I am referring to is that inner being that is created in the image and likeness of the divine. In other words, I'm not talking about our physical body. I'm not talking about mm-hmm. our emotional and mental body. I'm talking about the spiritual body, that internal essence that really is what we are.
Right.
It's invisible, it's intangible, but it is intelligent, and it is powerful. And so that's why over the entranceway to the ancient Kemetic temples was the inscription, "Know thyself." And most people, when we see that, we think it's saying, oh, get in touch with yourself. And on a surface level, that's exactly what it's saying. But at the much deeper level, it's saying, know the intelligence, the genius, the forces that motivate us to be who we are. In other words, know the inner self, mm-hmm. because that is, in fact, in essence, who we be. Mm-hmm. And once we know that for ourselves, we also discover that same essence resides in everyone else as well. And so what it boils down to, Sister Q, is that because I know this inner essence about myself, I also recognize it in you. And because I have come not only to recognize it, to be able to observe it, and to know it, but I also am imbued with this sense of love that emanates from it. In other words, we're back to giving, seeking nothing in return. So that mm-hmm. energy in me recognizes that energy in you, and that's what guides how I interact with you or anyone else. In other words, I want for you the same goodness that I would want for myself. And I would not do anything to you that I would not do to myself, or to reverse that, because I recognize that special inner quality about you, then my intention is to see that manifest itself in its highest expression. In other words, it goes back to the quote from Dr. King, I can never be all that I'm supposed to be until you're all that you're supposed to be. And so yes. You see how that kind of dynamic changes the way we interact with each other. So it could never be a situation where I'm trying to manipulate you to get something that I want, because I recognize that you are so much more than I can comprehend. And so the only thing that I would be compelled to do would be to assist you in whatever way I could for you to reach your highest expression, your highest potential. Imagine if we interacted with each other that way all the time. You know, when we come into a room, our goal is to make sure that everyone present leaves there stronger than when they came in, leaves there more dynamic, more brilliant, has more information, more knowledge, is able to do more than they were able to do when they entered. I mean, and that was the goal every time we got together. Would change very dramatically how we behave towards one another. Because tragically, what we see happening is we're doing just the opposite. I beat you down. I call you out of your name. I'm in competition with you. So it's always a one-upmanship kind of energy around us. I'm jealous of you if what you're doing, you know, causes me not to shine as brightly as you are. All of those very negative behaviors that we get into because we are not pursuing this idea of loving each other, that is giving, seeking nothing in return. So that's what I mean by love, and that's what I mean by self, the mm-hmm. internal essence of each and every person. I'll pause because you had a second question.
No, I don't have the second question. Well, not about that part. But thank you very, very much for that definition, defining those terms. I really appreciate that. My second question, I guess, is like for tonight's conversation, what do you mean when you say fascism?
Okay. And I'm glad you asked that question. I'm glad you put it in the order that you did. We find ourselves, I believe, living in a historical moment where there is extreme violence. I was going to say swirling around us, but it's raging around us almost 24/7, 365. I was thinking about the mall shooting in Allen, Texas last week, where the gunman shot and killed 8 people and wounded others. And either the same day or shortly thereafter, another person in a SUV plowed into a group of people waiting at a bus stop, killing 8 of them. And in light of these continuing mass shooting and mass killing events, none of the legislatures, state or federal, are talking about things that we can do as a country to get our arms around the mass killing spree that's just raging out of control. Nothing being said about restricting the sale of these AR-15s, these large magazines, all of this powerful weaponry that is available to just about anyone. And instead of doing anything to bring that under control, a lot of the states that have Republican leadership are doing just the opposite. They're making it easier for people to have access to these high-powered weapons without any kind of background check or training or anything. So the population in the United States is about 330 million people. There's over 400 million guns in circulation. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it's almost like there's a gun and a half for every person walking the street. you couple right. that with a population that has been completely stoked with fear and made to be afraid of, quote unquote, the other, whether the other is black or brown people or immigrants or women or, you know, any group that now is under attack, Muslims. So now everybody is kind of on a hair trigger alert and suspicious of everybody else. That climate of violence and pushing towards an authoritarian government, anti-democratic, anti-equality, that's fascism. We saw it in Europe during World War II with the rise of Hitler and Nazi Germany. And oftentimes, you know, people talk about the fact that they exterminated 6 million Jews during the Holocaust and, you know, that was a terrible thing. And indeed, it certainly was. What they don't talk about, and we credit Dr. Francis Kress Welting for bringing it to our attention, that it was 14 million people that the Nazis killed in Germany and Europe. 6 million of them were Jews. So the question is who were the other 8 million? We know a large segment of them were the people that were called Roma, or the slur term was gypsies, but as vile, as incomprehensible as it was and is, to think that Hitler put 6 million people in ovens and gas chambers and just flat out shot and killed them, that's a horrible number. But in truth, it was 14 million. We don't even talk about who the other 8 million were. But that was the climate that was whipped up in Germany to a fever pitch and then unleashed, resulting in World War II. The same scenario played out in Italy under the dictator Mussolini. And there was a similar leader in Spain. His name will come to me in a minute. So these countries in Europe put in place these dictators and created an authoritarian governmental rule that resulted in millions and millions of people being killed. And if you weren't of the nationality of the ruling party, your life could be cut short. That's fascism. It's where the most violent strata of the society sees control of the governmental apparatus, install a dictator, and they just run it to benefit themselves. I mean, it's white nationalism on steroids. And we have to be, black folks need to be very clear that what we are living through in this moment is a rebirth of that white nationalism. It never went away. You know, it kind of went underground for a minute, but now it's back in full force. And so we see it, I mean, you know, here in the United States, with the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol, with the emergence of these extreme far-right paramilitary groups, the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, who are armed to the teeth and just waiting to be let loose. That's fascism, and that's what's riling up in the United States. And that's why, and the challenge of all of this, Sister Q, is because we are also in late-stage capitalism, where in order for the 1% to maintain control in the United States, that is this very small handful of white males, because of the demographics have changed in the country, and white folks are on the verge of being a minority in this country, they're ready to say, you know, throw all that democratic stuff out the window. We are not relinquishing power, and we're going to stay in control by any means necessary. And they mean that literally. And if we think they don't, we fool ourselves. When we see these various Republican governors rolling back any kind of safety measures in terms of weapons and that kind of stuff, and we're thinking to ourselves, well, surely after this last mass killing, they're gonna legislate some laws to bring this stuff under control, and they're not doing that. And that's because they have a very specific agenda. They don't care if democracy collapses. As long as white men maintain control of the governmental apparatus, then that's the end game that they want to achieve. Too many of us are thinking that somehow another group is going to prevail and save the day and turn the clock back, turn the tide back. I'm not so sure about that because two things are going to either happen. A, they're going to continue to let the violence escalate until all of the social systems break down and we find ourselves in a situation of martial law, or they're just going to force it to the breaking point and take to the streets with their guns and rule by force. And so the fact that they're willing to do that should really tell us all that we need to know. And our problem is that they're very clear about their agenda. Mm-hmm. The white nationalists are very clear. White nationalism, white supremacy, they're going to stay in power at all costs. And the reason they need to do that is because not only do they need to control the economics in this country, they are part of an international organization that controls the economics globally. When I think about what we learned in eighth grade American history and world history when we were in school, Sister Q, it was almost pathetic. We were told that World War One and World War Two had to do with these European nations fighting among themselves and, you know, yada, 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 you know. So Germany and Italy and Spain were against, you know, France and England, et cetera. What they did not tell us was what they were fighting about. And what they were fighting about was which of them would control the African continent. That was true then, and it's true today. Who is going to control the unbelievable wealth of the African continent, both in terms of its mineral wealth, whether we're talking lithium for these batteries or coltan for the telephones and the computers and the cell phones, et cetera, the cobalt for the aluminum, the gold, the diamonds, the oil. Africa is just unlimited in terms of its mineral wealth. And whoever controls Africa controls the world. We as African Americans should understand that our role in all of this is to work, A, with ourselves, with our sisters and brothers on the continent to guarantee that we are the controllers of our own destiny by creating our own economic system. And the only reason that we don't do this is that we've been brainwashed and conditioned to think that these white folks are the only ones that know how to run the planet. And we're divided.
Brother,
so we're confused. Go ahead.
I was going to say, finish your thought, please. We have a hand up. So when you finish your thought, we're going to take that call.
Well, think about this, Sister Q. here we are, untapped genius inside of ourselves. There's absolutely nothing we can't do because as spirit beings, we're just unlimited in our potential. But we have been reduced to thinking of ourselves as mere human beings. And so we argue, we fuss, we fight, we call our women bees and hoes. We refer to ourselves as atomic dogs or the N-word or anything but the divine beings that we are. We are divided by any number of things, whether it's class or skin coloration or religion or fraternity, sorority, all of these allegiances that we hold to, but we haven't figured out a way to come together as a people and to reclaim our humanity and our dignity and build a world that is safe for ourselves and our children. And that's because we don't really understand the self. And we have not made the decision to love ourselves unconditionally. We are still angry about a lot of things. And unfortunately, we're allowing our fear for us to take that anger out on each other rather than to understand that our very survival is at stake and we have to put those smaller, petty things aside, join hands, and start working together for a much larger purpose. I'll pause there and let's hear the comment of the question.
Caller with the last 4 digits, 3440, please state your name, where you're calling from, make your comment or ask your question. Thank you.
Yeah, greetings, Sister Q and Brother Auntie. This is Brother Shabaka calling from South Florida. I hope the weather up there is just as comfortable as it is down here. You all have a very dynamic show going on right now. Great. I'm glad to hear that. I wanted Brother Auntie to elaborate a little bit more on the question of democracy and what have you. In the context of the United States, have democracy ever been practiced, and to whom? If you could do that, because we know that as black people, as African people, we haven't experienced it. But has it been practiced by other folks? And I'm not thoroughly convinced of that. The second is dealing with the concept of love that you were talking about earlier. Please correct me. In order for that love to be practiced, it has to be nurtured. And that nurturing, is just not individual. It's just that nurturing has to be part of the environment to be able to sustain and expand that. If the environment that we're in antithetical to that expression, what then would be needed in order to change that environment such that, and then what is the mindset that we would have to be able to change that mindset such that what you describe becomes practical and sustainable in some sort of a nurturing environment?
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Shabaka. Always good to hear you. While the weather here is not as good as it is there in South Florida, it's getting better than it has been, that's for sure. The first response to your question about democracy, as you well alluded to, America has never practiced democracy. I mean, when we think about the fact that slavery was almost 200 years in practice at the time that the country was formed into the 13 colonies forming the United States? How can there be democracy when a large segment of the population is in fact enslaved? In addition to that, as many of us recognize, the only people that could vote were, you had to be 21, white, and a landholder. So if you did not own land, you weren't considered a citizen, or let me put it this way, you didn't have the privilege of voting. You had to own land in order to vote. So no, democracy has never existed in the United States. Part of our struggle has been to see if it can exist. America seems to be hell-bent on saying, no, not here, not now, not never. That remains to be seen, whether or not that rabbit can actually be pulled out of the hat. But your point is absolutely well taken. We have not seen a thorough, genuine democracy in this country. And what little that had been extended towards black folks and women now is being rolled back again. So in Holder versus Shelby County in 2013, the Supreme Court shot down the Voting Rights Act. And as soon as that was over, as soon as Section 4 of the Voting Rights Bill was overturned, was the preclearance bill. In other words, before states could make any changes in their voting regulations, it had to be precleared with the Justice Department, the Federal Justice Department. Well, what the Shelby decision said was that discriminated against the states, and they no longer had to get preclearance. Well, once that was done, South Carolina, Texas, Louisiana, South Carolina immediately began to put in all kinds of voter ID restrictions, and the floodgates opened, and those voting rights that we had enjoyed from 1965 up until 2013 were soon thrown out of the window. So and we haven't really had a conversation about that, and what, how do we combat that? So that's what I would say in terms of the democracy piece. But it is, I do think, Brother Shabaka, it's important for us to reaffirm and understand that democracy is not something that Europeans came up with. Even going back to ancient Greece, they learned democracy from African civilizations and what African people were doing on the continent before the Europeans invaded and destroyed much of these African institutions and African way of life. What was the second question, Sister Q? The critical question, I got it, was this love that I was talking about has to be nurtured. And that's the perfect segue to talk about the Ulu-based communities, the UBCs. Precisely because of what Brother Shabaka was saying, we recognize that we have to create an incubator, if you will, an environment, a safe space, a sacred space, where a number of people can be in proximity to one another and create the energetic envelope in which this love can be nurtured, where it can grow up into full maturity. And so that is what the Ulu based communities is designed to do. These are small communities, neighborhoods, if you will, anywhere 25 to 100 people who come together. They occupy the same geographic location. You know, in other words, in Atlanta, it would be, for example, West End. There are always these communities in cities where black folks have lived and do live, where we have these areas where blacks have congregated, they live together, they've gone to school together. So the idea is in these areas to form these communities where we practice Ma'at and the Nguza Saba. In other words, we are very intentional and very deliberate about creating healthy communities where the practice, the day-to-day practice, is actually loving, respecting one another, and working together to build the institutions that we need. It's a very exciting thing. There's a brother in Atlanta, speaking of Atlanta, in the Western area, who is developing the concept of what he calls Kijiji villages, where they're going to actually build neighborhoods and on an African architecture in a circle rather than in a rectangle, where a number of houses will be facing each other in a circle. There'll be a common space in the center, and they can begin to, you know, interact with each other in more healthy ways. We've been thinking about Ujamaa villages, which were kind of an extension of the Ulu March that we first launched Us Lifting Us with back in 2013. Again, where small groups of us would come together, purchase land, build housing, build our ability to feed ourselves, shelter ourselves, clothe ourselves, similar to what Mwalimu Julius Nyerere was doing in Tanzania in what he called the Ujamaa villages, because he discovered that our people, in order to build together, we have to be next to each other. You know, doing it virtually doesn't always get the job done. So when there's proximity, when we're close to one another, when we can commune and talk to each other on a day-to-day basis, you know, work shoulder to shoulder, we can accomplish anything we put our minds to. And so the idea is that we're going to create, we will begin in Atlanta with a pilot Ulu-based community, 25 to 100 people, where we're going to come together and start doing the research of our area, figuring out what economic enterprises, cooperative enterprises, we can operate in that space, and begin to do for self and love ourselves. And that model will then be replicated across the country. So I think I'm answering your question, Brother Shabaka. Any questions or comments?
No, I have no questions. I did have a thought when you were speaking of these villages. I remember a few years back hearing about a community that was being built somewhere in the South. I don't remember which state. But before they built the houses, they asked the people that was the target of that housing to give them input on what they wanted the houses to look like, what they wanted to be in the houses, on the land or whatever. And one of the things that was asked for and implemented was a porch. They said each mm-hmm. house must have a porch because we are basically outside people, and we interact with each other mm-hmm. more, like we come sit outside on the porch so we can see what's going on. Or, mm-hmm. you know, the neighbor passing by, you hail them up as they're going, you know, from your porch or whatever. And I think mm-hmm. that is one of the things that, little things like that we don't think about in terms of designing houses. And I'm not saying that Kijiji doesn't have that. I'm just saying it's, you know, something that was brought to mind by what you were saying about us building the kind of housing that resonates with us.
Right. I agree. There, Brother Shabaka is probably familiar with this because he lived in Baltimore for a number of years. But there are planned communities all across this country. Reston, Virginia comes to mind, Columbia, Maryland. There's a place in Atlanta called Saran Bay Farms, where these are spaces where, and they vary anywhere from 300 or 400 acres to, you know, thousands of acres, where groups intentionally have come together and built residential, commercial, industrial, and recreational areas where they can live in community with each other, and that's the goal of Us Lifting Us, to build planned communities, planned intentional villages based on our culture, our life ways, that enable us to, going back to Shabaka's question, that enable us to love one another and to love ourselves, and to do it practically, so there's a material reality that is born out of that. We are able to feed ourselves, clothe ourselves, shelter ourselves, recreate together, educate our children, provide healing modalities to keep us healthy, to provide spaces for the elderly to make a contribution to the village for as long as they're here, as mm-hmm. part of the village, and not be stuck off somewhere in an old folks home, left to die by themselves. The point I think that I want to share as our time begins to wind down, Sister Q, we were the original builders of civilization. And I want this point to get through before we do run out of time. The language that the ancient people of Kemet spoke, they called it Metuneter, Metuneter, or Medu Neter. Medu means words. Neter means deity or divinity or God. In other words, they refer to their language as words of the gods. Now, people need to let that sink in. They developed a language, and they called it Medu Neter. In other words, the words that flow out of my mouth are words of the gods. So, in other words, they saw themselves as these divine beings. No N word, no B, no H. If I'm speaking God words, then I too must be a god or a goddess. So from that starting point, there's the realization that we have a very different conceptualization of how the world can be organized. Going back to your comment, Sister Q, about building a house with a porch. Well, obviously, you know, we would do that.
Right.
You know, because we know that that's how we communicate. But we've allowed ourselves to be shoehorned into these subdivisions, many that don't have porches. And so, you know, you drive down the street, you click your garage opener, the door slides up, you drive in, you hit the button, it shuts back down, and boom. You don't see anybody. That's not our conceptualization of how we want to live together. And so the point is that based on our value system, that is Ma'at and Nguza Saba, that means we create a very different kind of living environment. Our school system is very different. One of the things that comes out very clearly is that in African-centered school systems, they do two things. A, they transmit the content and the wisdom of the culture, but equally important, they transmit character. So So in other words, you cannot be a product of those school systems and come out a liar and a cheater and a cusser and a foolish person. No, you come out of those school systems with wisdom, with respect, with integrity, to the point where your word is your bond.
For sure.
Or my bond is my word. In other words, you mean something. You stand for something in the world, but that only happens when you have gone through a process that is intentional about you coming out the other end with those kinds of attributes and characteristics. So we have to develop a different kind of educational model for our children. We have to develop a different way of doing business together. Hence, when we talk about Uru cooperatives, not only are we talking about group ownership of the business, but we're talking about how we treat each other inside of the business. Back to Shabaka's point about democracy, our businesses are democratic places. We meet both as shareholders and workers to decide and how this business will be operated. The voice of everybody that's a stakeholder is important, and we operate on consensus so that when we make a decision, everybody is on board with that. It's not just, you know, we take a vote and the majority rules. No,
right.
if the minority forces are unhappy or not comfortable with the decisions, then that probably is not a good decision for this group. So we have to rethink, revamp, and rebuild every aspect of our lives based on these African philosophical ideas that our forebears had developed for thousands of years, millennia ago, and that we've become disconnected from because of colonialism and enslavement. But these principles, these guidelines, are now being made available to us once again. We are re-embracing them, and that is why we have to build our own communities. And as we build these communities, we're also modeling for others a way of healthy living in the world. And as these communities connect and become larger and larger institutions, now we have a global reality that works for the majority of our people and the planet. So let me pause there, Sister Q.
Excuse me, we have no more hands up, so you can continue. I have no questions.
Okay. So the last point I would make would simply be this. It is this ability to be very intentional, and it's a decision. In other words, you and I may have history together, and there may have been some tension points, and we may not have always seen eye to eye, but because of the reality that's staring us in the face, we recognize, you know, we better work together if we plan to be here. And from this point going forward, we agree that what's going to guide the way we interact with each other is that we are going to love ourselves. We're going to give to one another, seeking nothing in return. I'm not trying to manipulate you. I'm not trying to con you out of anything. I'm not trying to take advantage of you to line my pocket. We simply are going to work together so that we can create something that's beneficial for both of us and bigger and better than anything that we individually could do on our own. That's a matter of a choice and a decision. We'll come to feel good about it later on as we are successful in building the institutions that we need. But at the beginning, it's a decision. It's a choice that we as mature women and men are making for our survival and for the survival of the generations who are coming behind us. And we're very clear that all of this negative talk that we that has gone on amongst us for too long, that has to be put aside. You know, this cussing each other out, this calling people out of their names, all of these behaviors that are destructive to the body and the mind, we are making a conscious decision to lay that aside. We're only going to do those things that guarantee that we are functioning at our best and at our highest at all times. It's going to demand some effort for certain, but the end result will be a healthy, sovereign, self-determining people. And I know that's what the ancestors want for us. And I believe that we have it within ourselves to create these kinds of spaces and inside of these spaces to build these institutions.
I agree with you 100% regarding all it takes is a decision and then to follow up on it and to not give up every
yes.
time there's a mistake. Not a mistake, a misstep, you know, what somebody would say, something they didn't, you know, because we are coming from a different environment. So we can't expect that we will all cross the line and then forget everything that we have been exposed to previously and go forward straight up. So we have to be patient with each other and understand that if I say something from my old life and you say, Sister Q, we don't talk like that anymore, I don't rear up and start cussing at you because you have insulted me. You know, so it like you said, a decision. And having made the decision, we have to go inside each other and ourselves. What does that really look like? And are you helping me get there, or am I resistant? And if so, why? You know, so that was. Thank you very much.
You said something about
the definition.
You said something about it. You said something, we make a misstep. And I'm just reminded of something a community organizer said to me a long time ago. He said, to stumble is not to fall, but to go forward faster. And that stayed with me. Because, you know, sometimes we stumble and we think, oh, my gosh, you know, it's the end of the world. But no, you just, you know, regain your balance, you regain your footing, and keep pressing our way.
For sure. Okay, so we have no more hands up. So I think it is almost 10 o'clock then. Yes, it is. So if you do you have anything else you want to make sure people take with them tonight, Brother Ankit?
Just to go to the website and to watch our progress. Things are changing, and we can't do this by ourselves. We need everybody to join the party. So go to the website, stay in touch, hit the join button if you're not a member. If you are a member, jump into the online community, raise your hand, tell us what it is that you are willing to contribute, and let's work together.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Brother
Ankit,
we want to thank everyone that joined us this evening. We invite you to join us again next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock Eastern Time for another installment of Dare to Win. Peace.
Peace.
Oh, yeah. You. I'ma let you know. You can't.